Michael's in charge, great. Like to call the meeting to order, and do we do that formally with a resolution, Pierre, or do we just commence? We can just commence our meeting, right? Before we get into other business, we have the minutes that were circulated to everybody from, well, let me actually take a step back. We have some new members with us today, and rather than speaking on their behalf, perhaps starting with Susanna, we can go around the room and introduce the new members to the council.
I'm Susanna Fessler. I'm a professor in the East Asian Studies Department in the College of Arts and Sciences, and I'm here in the capacity of being the vice chair of the Senate.
Welcome.
My name is Nick Farenkoff. I'm a 2008 graduate of the University of Albany and current PhD student in the Nano College, and I'm here as the elected graduate student representative.
Great. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. My name is Stephen Guarneri, and I'm a junior at the university. I'm involved with the Student Association as a senator at large, and it's a pleasure to be here today. Thank you.
Thanks. So it's great to have all of you. Welcome to everybody.
Is David new to the meeting, or you've been here before?
David, yeah, please. Either way, please.
David McCaffrey, I'm a professor in public administration policy. I'm here in my capacity as co-director of the Institute for Community Morning Regulation.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last part.
David McCaffrey from public administration policy at the university, and I'm here in my capacity as co-director of the Institute for Financial Market Regulation.
Did you catch that, Pat?
Got it.
Okay, great. And Vince, since you were here, maybe you want to, for those who don't know, Vince, George's chief of staff, Vince Delio.
Says it all.
There you go. To say more would probably be dangerous. Well, welcome, everybody. It's good to see old faces and new faces, and I think it's exciting to be here on the East Campus. Hopefully you had a moment to catch some of the remarks celebrating the 25th anniversary of the School of Public Health. There is a reception after the meeting, so for those who weren't able to participate earlier, there's obviously an opportunity to congregate and gather and talk. I don't know if Commissioner Daines, who's the Commissioner of Health, is staying for that, but he is here.
Dark chocolate and wine. Currently,
red wine.
It's a health
red wine, probably.
Or a Belgian fest. Right, thank you, Pierre. And not joining us today, we do have a new council member, Jim Clancy. Who was recently appointed by Governor Patterson. He is an alum, class of 90. He currently is working at the Department of Health, and we look forward to having his presence soon. I think, George, I don't know if you were able to catch with him briefly.
Yeah, I had a nice long chat with him. He's very excited about joining the council. He wants to be involved. He's had a wonderful experience here as an undergraduate, so he wants to give back to the university. And that's the kind of council member we want. So
great. I know Pierre had an opportunity to catch up with him, too. We have a full agenda today, a lot of topics to discuss. George, I know you had an order of high priority you wanted to address first.
I would like to have one of you guys go into it. I'd like to go into executive session.
And the topic, I think the subject
matter
is...
It will relate to issues surrounding personnel, and that's the...
Right.
Dan, so, I make a motion to go into executive session.
Second.
Thank you. Okay.
Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Yeah, I did.
Okay. Thank you.
Statutory members only.
Appreciate your patience.
Okay.
Okay. I got lost too. So that's it.
Well, thank you, everybody.
Recording.
For those who are waiting out in the halls while we we're in executive session, I appreciate your patience. And but we're back, and we're back on the agenda. The next item up was the meeting minutes from the previous meeting. I don't know if anybody has any comments to offer on the minutes. If not, I would request a motion to adopt the minutes.
I would make that motion.
I'll second that.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Okay. That motion passes. Next up, George, report from the president.
You're not sick of hearing from me already. summer was very busy on this campus. First of all, in terms of today, those of you who got here a little bit later, we are beginning our year-long celebration of the 25th anniversary of our School of Public Health. It was a very nice program to start with. Included in that program was an announcement of two new faculty grants, which I think amounted to six million or more, almost seven million. In new grants, which is terrific. And this is a program that started out with six students 25 years ago, and now there are 400 students, and it's growing. So we're very proud of that, and that's an example of the, you know, the entrepreneurial nature of the university and the relationships that we create with, between the university and, the, in this case, the Wadsworth Laboratory and the health department. This summer, as you know, our provost was actively engaged in what appears to be at least a 20-year project in this strategic planning thing, but it wasn't 20 years in the making, but we've gone a long way in terms of our strategic planning from last winter. We have a pretty much a draft report. We're working on what we call a crosswalk to make sure that it conforms with other documents on campus. We'll have a big release, and frankly, I think it's a wonderful document, and I think it does set, it creates a blueprint for us in terms of moving forward. And again, kudos to Susan Phillips, who has done the lion's share of all of the work. And I'm not going to take the time in going into all the themes. I have notes here to go into the themes, but you guys will be here forever, and those people who are waiting in the hall are not going to be too patient about me going into that. Anyway, the process is important because it included about 300 members of our university community in the different iterations of the process. So, again, it was a collaborative plan. It was something that was where we sought input from virtually every constituency on campus, and it was I think very thoughtful and frankly so sorely needed because we did not have a strategic plan on this campus. The reaccreditation process with Middle States, I had mentioned during the executive session that we have were through it. We had rave reviews on our self-study. Primarily, which really kind of amazed me, is to the shocking fact that they found our honesty shocking. They apparently they don't get honesty everywhere, we revealed all of our warts, and that served us very well in terms of the process, and we got pretty much a wonderful report and some very nice accolades, and again. This was a process that was heavily participative, and lots of committees and lots of people on campus worked very hard. And again, it's to their great credit that that we're at the next step. We continue to have a number of accreditation bodies on campus. I'm continually amazed because when I think it's over, there's another one. There's one on Monday. Susan briefed me so I wouldn't make a fool of myself on Monday when they came in recently, yesterday. So. You know, I'll sleep on the materials so that I don't screw up. But they're on campus all the time. It's particularly difficult in an environment of the resource environment that we currently have because quality is never the issue. It's the quantitative elements that create problems for us. It's the number of faculty members. It's the ratios. It's that sort of thing. Quality is never the issue. It's quantity that we have to address. And as we mentioned earlier when we talked about, you know, next steps, it is critically important that we invest in areas so we don't lose accreditation in our important programs. We launched two exciting institutes, the Institute for Financial Market Regulation. David is the great architect of the institute. We've had wonderful traction. It's a great collaboration. It's Rockefeller College is part of it. Our College of Computing and Information, our School of Business, Center for Technology and Government, Albany Law School, and a plethora of very important regulatory and industry leaders that participate with us. And it is the model for the future. And again, all credit for that go to David and his collaborators, but David and principally David. And he's here in the room to answer any questions you might have. But we had a program in Washington recently with some great excitement. We've gotten a lot of traction from the federal government in terms of interest in helping fund this program. We've placed many of our, already placed our graduates in very, very good positions in the regulatory environment, and clearly we did this well in advance of the financial crisis. So this was not being opportunistic when we saw the crisis. We David and his colleagues foresaw the need for this program in advance, had it well along the before the financial crisis. So that's, again, to their great credit, because this was not a knee-jerk reaction. It was not, oh, let's jump into this thing because there are this was something that we anticipated was needed, and we acted on it. So I'm very proud of that. And we also are, and incidentally, this is the first of its kind in the nation. So I like that. I like being first. I like the fact that that we're doing things not because others are doing them, because we think that they're necessary, but because we think they're necessary. And again, I'll defer to David to answer any questions you might have about that. And we've also launched a pioneering RNA Institute, which is we announced it June 4th. We brought in two new faculty members, Paul Agris, who was a faculty member at the North Carolina State University, and Dan Febreze, Dan, who was a faculty member at the University of Maryland. Both are top-notch researchers in the area of RNA. It is exciting in the sense that this is one of a very few programs of its kind in the nation. And again, I will defer to the scientists because, I know about messenger RNA and I know about all these little things, but I'm not going to make a fool of myself and explain any of that stuff. But it does bring together a powerful alliance of genetic scientists and biomedical investigators to our campus. It gives us lots of opportunities for partnership. Hopefully, we were hoping, for example, that one of the advantages of the FIA transaction was the opportunity to perhaps co-locate some pharmaceutical researchers, in the life science building to be co-tenants with the RNA Institute, to be able to perhaps take some of the research that goes on and create commercial applications and provide another revenue source for the university, but that didn't happen. It's a model that certainly, I think, we're going to have to address in the future, because the opportunity is too great to enhance what very limited resources we have at the university. But it is cutting edge, it's exciting, and we have just gotten last week an announcement from Health and Human Services from Washington that we were given a $5.4 million NIH ARRA grant to construct the facilities. So $5.4 million is a significant ARRA grant. We think it's the second highest grant that SUNY has received.
Over a decade?
Yeah, that of its kind. So that's exciting. We've had Dan Febreze secured about $1 million competitive NIH grant already, and they're barely moved onto the campus. And we have gotten an additional $500,000 from Congressman Tonko his personal appropriation to assist in that. So we've gotten a lot of traction and a lot of interest. And again, this is hopefully will be very quickly an area of great strength for the university, as will be the Center for Financial Market Regulation. So I'm very proud of both of those. On the capital side, which we talked about earlier, which is always going to be a problematic when people see, capital construction going on during an environment of, fiscal restraint. You all understand the difference between capital and operating monies. At the end of the day, it's a zero-sum game with capital. We're pigs at the trough. We're going to get as much as we possibly can, because if we don't get it, Stony Brook gets it, or somebody else gets it. Right now on campus, we have a $70 million student housing project that's being constructed. That is not part of capital. Student housing on campus is self-sustaining. We actually go out and borrow the money, and the students pay for the debt service and all of the other costs attached to student housing. So that is literally, we go out like anybody else, borrow the money, build the facilities, and use the revenue that we generate from those facilities to pay the debt. And that's the model that we use in terms of housing across the board. That's unfortunately what happens is that when we build new housing, often the old housing helps subsidize that. I'm a big person in terms of not screwing the kids. We do a pretty good job once in a while doing that. School of Business, $54 million. We've mentioned it in the past. 90,000 square feet. The actual construction will begin this summer. We've delayed it so that we can hold our spring graduation in the front. The slight delay will not impact the opening because we need to open it during specific periods. So it won't be unsightly when the graduation takes place. The next day it'll be unsightly. It'll be quickly unsightly. $40 million campus center expansion, very much needed on the campus. We have no facilities for our student groups on campus, 250 student groups. No office areas, no staging areas. I tell the story, you've heard it, walking on campus on one of the weekends. I went up the back stairs trying to get where I was supposed to be and didn't realize that the area outside of Assembly Hall was being used as a dressing room. It wasn't the male dressing room, and I walked in. It was not a pleasant thing, and of course, I almost fell down the stairs walking backwards to get out. But that's the kind of the point is that facilities that are currently there are being used for purposes that they weren't intended to be used for, because there are no facilities. So that is going to be great in terms of improving the quality of life on the campus. We also have a five-year deferred maintenance program that's going on. It's about $33 million a year. The manifestation of that is like new windows. And if you notice the windows, those buildings actually look newer. When you see the new, I'm amazed at how because I didn't think that anyone even noticed new windows. But they do improve the side of it. So we're doing all of that, and I'm trying to go quickly. I'm sorry. Giant Camp was here. It was another success. We have two one-year options that remain on the contract. We're not going to be talking about options because, frankly, we don't know whether there's going to be a lockout for the next year, and we also don't know what's going to happen in terms of their practice facility in New Jersey. But this year, we had about 40,000 visitors, which is the fifth all-time, but on a per-day basis, it was second because this was the shortest camp we had had. So it seems to be, continues to be very successful. I won't talk about enrollment because I believe that Wayne is going to have an element on the thing about enrollment. You're not?
I'm here.
Oh, I was looking for you. You were
hiding. How did you miss me?
How the hell did I miss you?
How can you?
How do you miss Wayne?
Oh, man.
Well, listen. Jeez. Wayne's the only one in the room that weighs more than I do. So. Anyway, the opening, the fall semester opening was terrific. We had what I was most pleased with was after the weekend activities. And in particular, I was pleased with the lecture series that went on. I've always been impressed with our faculty, but I stopped into as many of the lectures as possible. And man, these guys are good. They were fabulous. The people who participated in that weekend program did a wonderful job. The kids were energized. They were all well attended. We had several thousand students that participated, and I thought that was terrific. The other thing that I thought was absolutely fabulous was our students' response to the Hannah's Hope Appeal. Young lady who is originally from that lives in Clifton Park, I believe right now, has an ailment called giant axonal neuropathy, which is an orphan disease. It's one of these very rare diseases that gets very little attention because not enough people have it to justify any significant research by the pharmaceutical companies because it's not commercially viable to do it. Very little money is being invested in looking for a cure. When the parents received word of the diagnosis, the mother, who I am incredibly impressed with, I am also a father, but they decided after they picked themselves up off the floor, it's a terminal illness, that they were going to do something about it. And they have raised $2.5 million dollars for research on their own. PepsiCola had this challenge, this grant, which was $250,000, which was intended to finance a trial of a new drug. There were numerous charities that were involved in this thing, and you had to be first or second to get it. When they came to us, and we knew of the family because, well, to be really honest with you, one of the reasons we knew of the family is that Vince went to school with the father in Plattsburgh, New York, and also went to college with him in Lemoyne. Then he went to real college. We ended up, our students were instrumental in taking them from what started out as fifth to fourth to third, ultimately to second, and we happen to know that they achieved second by like
two votes.
So if you ever think that you're, and I take great pride because I sent the very first text message of my life. So I figure I'm one of those two votes because I had no way I would have sent a text message. I had to get help. So that was wonderful, and our kids really felt the pride in that, and the family was wonderful in recognizing the contributions of our students. Our faculty and researchers continue to be highly successful. Six UAlbany professors were named Fulbright Scholars for 2010-2011. I won't go through all this, but it's just an impressive list of achievements that we have. There's a lot going on campus to be proud of, and I'll end my report there and answer any questions. Sorry, I said it would be short, and I wasn't.
That's great.
It
was good.
Yeah, one of our alums, Scott McGovern, was killed at 9/11, and he had a wonderful experience as an undergraduate at the university, and a bunch of his buddies have gotten together over the years to celebrate his memory, and have they've created on campus Scott McGovern Scholarship Fund, which started out at a very modest amount. The most recent golf tournament that they had on Long Island, they presented us with a check for $100,000, and that brings the total scholarship fund up to $525,000, which is a wonderful thing. In honor of their friend, they've been very, very consistent. I called Mrs. McGovern yesterday, and we've been trading calls, but it's terrific. And also, while we're at it, one of our very own made a very generous contribution to her graduate alma mater, Pat. We're very thankful to Pat for her generous contribution.
Thank you, George. Anybody have questions for George? Okay. Great report. The institution continues to show its strengths, showcased in a lot of different ways. Report from the vice chair, I'll be short. I think we were fairly in depth, although on a focused basis in the executive session, and George obviously has given a great overview on what's going on across campus. I think it's great, just as a matter of note, to hold this meeting on the East Campus and get everybody an opportunity to be here. I think it shows a lot of support from the council to the body here on the East Campus, and it's a wonderful range of things that are done here, and if you haven't had the opportunity to take a look at it, I really encourage you to do so. As George has highlighted, these are extraordinary times, both on the accomplishments and on the challenges, and I think George and the faculty and the students and everyone involved has been doing a great job. What you hear about Albany out and about, it's just the quality of the institution and what it's getting done, and I think that speaks so highly for all of you in this period. I would encourage each of you to stay involved. Each voice is critical in addressing the many issues at large. There's a lot of skill sets on this council. I know you all provide your advice directly to George, but there are a lot of things that we can do, and I would encourage you to stay in constant contact with George and Vince and Fardeen and others about how we can all be helpful. So I think that's just a message we all have to just keep pushing on the things that are critical. Next up, student representatives. I think maybe we'll just start with the undergraduate representative first and then move on to Nick.
Sure. I just want to say that it's a tremendous feeling of joy to be here today. And as representing the students, I want to say it's a great university to be at, and I know this feeling can be felt on the campus. It's continuing to get better and only better. It's a great place to be right now, and our futures are in good hands being here at this university. We're going to get jobs leaving this school, and it's the right place to be right now. Other reports from the undergrad, nothing right as of now. I will continue to stay in touch with the president of the Student Association, the chair, continue to make announcements at the Senate meetings to bring ideas and ask students who are not directly involved with any type of thing that could be brought to this council. But last, I'd like to end on an invitation to all council members. Barbara Walters is coming on October 9th to the school. We're all looking forward to that. That's going to be a great day. Best interviewer, I feel. And you all have VIP passes. If you'd like, I can take any information down. And I'd be more than happy to stay in touch with email and get you those tickets and VIP passes. It's the October 9th.
Okay. Read your book in advance. It's quite a tell-all. I'll say that. Thank you. Nick?
Still feeling that I look forward to work with you guys this year.
Great. Thank you. Wonderful to have you. On the new business front, Pierre, I don't know if you want to introduce Jim Diaz and what we're doing. But
sure. Thank you. I attended the June 4th, I think, announcement on the RNA Institute and sat there, and I've been familiar with the Speakers Institute and the Rockefeller Institute and this center and that center, and I'm sitting there and I'm saying, I really don't know what an institute is. I don't know what a center is. I don't know the difference between a college and a school. And, sorry, but you know, sitting on the council for quite a while, probably should know some of that stuff. How are they governed? How are they composed, composited? All the great work that's being done, because I'm aware of David's work. So I just thought it would be a good opportunity to enlighten all of us, unless all of you know what an institute is and a center is and how they are joined by the university. So so we ask that the Jim Diaz come and make a presentation and offer some examples, and that's the introduction.
Well, good. Thank you, Jim.
I'm going to go to the front of the room because otherwise you'll be hearing my voice in the back and looking at the screen, and I've asked Nick to advance my slides.
Do you want to have the recorder up?
So what I'm going to talk about today are what we call research centers and institutes, but I'll also speak a little bit about units that are not involved in research but provide certain training, have training attributes, as well as other sort of what I would call public service attributes. Next slide, please. So the function of the research units are to conduct and facilitate coordinated research programs and to promote collaborations among and across disciplines. And what this means is that in the old days, if I was in the Department of Biology and I wanted to do a project that might involve someone in the Department of Chemistry, there may have been a wall between the two of us. And so what these centers do is they transcend those traditional barriers, and they bring people together in a structure above that and remove any of the barriers that might keep them from collaborating. Next slide, please. So why do we do this? Well, one of the reasons why we do this is to enhance the research strengths. If you remove those barriers, you bring people together, you get interdisciplinary collaborations. We think that by partnering between groups, it increases the propensity for extramural funding. And we also are able to try and get our research out of the benches, out of the laboratories, and into translation, either in community or in the medical community. And as I said before, it transcends these disciplinary boundaries. Next slide, please. Now, one of the important features of the units is their sustainability. As you can imagine, if I'm a faculty member in biology and I need a resource, I'll go to my chair, and if the chair doesn't have it, they'll go to the dean. And if the dean doesn't have it, they'll go to the provost and so forth. When you have a center and you're going across units, obviously there has to be a shared interest in sustaining that center. And if that doesn't happen, the center will go away. So one of the features of the research units or the centers are they're always having an eye on sustainability. That requires them to be entrepreneurial in how they're running their center. and looking for funds that could come from public sponsors, more traditional federal funding or state funding, but also from private sponsors. And George alluded to this with the RNA Institute, where just last week I was in a meeting with Paul Agris, where we had Affymetrix, a company from California, in learning about who the RNA Institute is, what are they doing, how can they partner with the Affymetrix platform that they use for microarray analysis in traditional research labs, but actually are moving that into the clinics now. And so it was a great opportunity, and they, by the way, were very impressed when they came and saw the vision. The university will commit some internal resources. Usually the VPR's office, Vice President for Research Office, will try and give a little bit of seed money if we have it. We'll partner with Academic Affairs if that's possible to try and initiate this. But we do expect these centers to sustain themselves with external funding. Next slide, please. So there are four types of program activities, and the ones that are most easy to understand in terms of research are what are characterized as institute centers and then specialized laboratories. And as I said previously, I'll talk a little bit about public service and training, which happens to be under this aegis of centers if you go on our website. Next slide, please. So the institute is really, you know, there's a lot of verbiage here, but basically the institute really is something that reaches outside of University of Albany. It looks to partner with Albany Med or RPI or Bassett Medical Center, and it really looks for, it really not only transcends the departmental boundaries, but it transcends the campus boundaries. It can be in-state, it can be out-of-state, and a good example of this that's recently evolved, I think, statewide is, and is in line with the Chancellor's strategic plan, is a program called SUNY REACH, which is a Research Excellence in Academic Health Centers, where they've, for example, formed an eye institute that is really all across the state involving many different institutions. So it removes those institutional barriers. And one of the more recent institutes that was approved last year, as George said, that Dave McCaffrey and Peter Bleonis in the College of Computation and Informatics is the Institute for Financial Market Regulation. Next slide, please. The centers are within the university, but again, providing opportunities to transcend the boundaries that might occur between schools or other programs. And so they are analogous to an institute that are usually kept inside the university. Now, again, when you think about a center like the Cancer Center, which has been in existence, I guess, for about 5 years, there are definitely going to be opportunities for partnering outside the university. And so I see as centers that have that opportunity should be considering moving up into an institute classification, where it's going to really get them thinking more about how to have a hub and spokes model with other institutions. And I'll just have here as one example the Cancer Research Center for Functional Genomics. Now, in the case of the Genesis Center, they needed to have scientific core facilities that would feed into their research paradigm, and so this particular center provides specialized capabilities for the Cancer Center, but those specialized capabilities are also available to everyone else at the Institute. And actually, they are really like Institute, because while I was at the Wadsworth Center, I used the Cancer Center core facilities for my own research. So there is that piece. Next slide, please. Finally, in terms of the organized research centers, I'm showing you a picture here of the Ion Beam.
Can I ask a question, just a quick one?
Yes.
Would there be a hesitation from moving up from, you know, the center to the institute upon the center?
I don't think
so. Is it higher revenue that they have to raise? Is
no,
it just more
no. There isn't that bar. There isn't that bar. It's really an organizational nomenclature. Yep. In fact, I think just the opposite. I think that centers will recognize that we are moving to a hub-and-spokes model, and that probably centers will have specialized reasons for existing within the institution, but most of them will try and reach out, depending, again, on the particular science that they're doing.
Thank you.
So the specialized laboratories are usually headed by a director as well, but they're really organized around a specific research need. So the ion beam laboratory, one of the things they do is when they're fashioning silicon wafers over at the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering, they'll bring these here to interrogate the surfaces of those wafers to look to see whether the chemistry that they're using on those wafers is working or how well it's working and so forth. And so this is an example of a very highly specialized facility that aids research within the institution. However, this ion beam lab actually does reach outside the institution. There was a small company that evolved from this run by Hasabak Group, who actually does analyses for places like Japan and around the world who need this particular kind of analysis but can't afford to do it themselves. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to give you kind of a flavor, and I don't have all the centers and all the institutes listed here, but I wanted to give you a flavor of some of the expenditures. Now, the expenditures are the amount of money that's spent annually, and it's really kind of where the rubber meets the road in terms of the business or the of what these folks are doing. One of our centers, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year, the Atmospheric Sciences Research Center, I think that's happening October 4th and 6th. It's going to be a really internationally recognized event because climate, which is what they work on, is a very, very hot topic. You read about the controversy in the newspapers and about the coral reefs that are now bleaching because of the warming of the atmosphere. And so they're really heavy hitters. Now these are just federal expenditures. They also have a state appropriation, which is actually part of our operating budget of about $1.3 million. So altogether, this is one of the heavy-hitting research centers at the University of Albany, and there are some other examples. I could talk about these ad nauseum, but I want to move along. So,
and they're all funded, self-funded through extramural funding?
So Atmospheric Sciences and the Center for Technology and Government have both federal funding and state funding.
Right.
The messaging that I'm giving them is that they really need to expand the federal funding. Now, ASRC, that's not an issue.
Right.
I'd like to see CTG double their federal funding. They're doing well. Teresa Pardo, who's the director, is out there. She's really looking for funding from NSF and other sources, as well as state funding that they can bring in that's independent of their line item funding.
Right. But these others are all funded through.
We need to do a lot more in terms of getting federal funding because, frankly, it's far greater advantage to us to get federal funding just because of the.
These are all external sponsored funds.
They are.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah. Okay, next slide. So I just wanted to mention that some of these centers have been around for a while. The Hindelang Research Center, they've been around for many years. Internationally known center that deals with criminal justice statistics, a source book that has 87,000 hits, downloads, 87,000 downloads, I think, annually. So people are actually reaching into this, taking the data and doing analyses with it. So here are some of the emerging organized research centers that are worthy of note. The Cancer Research Center doing about $860,000 per year in expenditures. The Center for Functional Genomics is actually part of the Cancer Research Center. It is, I don't include the amount of expenditures there, but actually they're funded primarily with FNA from that we get from federally funded grants. And the functional genomics folks are primarily specialized facilities that are available to the campuses I mentioned before. Larry Schell's new grant, Center for Elimination of Minority Health Disparities, is sustaining the center for elimination of minority health disparities. Of course, we're talking about Paul Eggers, who's shown here. over probably a helium tank going into an NMR machine at the RNA Institute, and then David McCaffrey and Peter with the Institute for Financial Market Regulation and RIG just moved back onto campus within the past year. And actually, Dan Nathans is giving a seminar, I think.
Dick Nathans.
Dan Nathans is the molecular biologist.
Dick is not a molecular biologist.
Yeah. next slide, please. Okay, so I just wanted to also mention that if you go to the research website, the Division of Research website, and pull up centers, you're also going to pull up these guys, the Professional Development Program and the Public Service Programs. Next slide. So one of the things that is going to jump out at you is that the Professional Development Program has about $31 million of expenditures per year. Gene Monaco manages this program, does a really fantastic job because basically it's all contracts. And what he has to do is he has to keep his staff in place as they move from contract to contract without losing the continuity of training. And so it's really if anybody wants to learn how to manage things and keeping things from falling through the cracks, Gene is probably the person. And I understand he also used to wrestle for you all at some point in his career.
A long time ago.
So CARD, or the Center for Autism-Related Disabilities, is another group. They go out and they train. So both Gene and CARD goes out into the community, and they're training the workforce that's out there. So the federal government or the state government may say, we've got a bunch of nurses out there, they don't know anything about HIV, put together a training program for them, or they don't know about the intersection between HIV and genome sequencing. Go out there. And so Gene and Kristen Christodopoulou go out and they train these people. Kristen is working in the schools, training the people who deliver care or supervision to kids who have autism or related disabilities in the classrooms. So when you think about workforce development that UAlbany does, and we're thinking about, well, let's put people in clean rooms, these folks are actually sustaining and training the workforce that's out there that's delivering stuff to us every day that we may not even realize that they're doing.
Do they also do training for the private sector or just probably?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't know if Gene's portfolio includes, but most of his work comes from the Office of Child Services and Family Assistance and OTDOT and OCFS is mainly what Gene does.
Well, the Small Business Development Center clearly is.
So I'm going to get to that one. Okay. Jim King runs the New York State Small Business Development Center. They have a $5.7 million a year portfolio, and they subcontract out to smaller units. Bob Brigham runs the one that UAlbany has, and I've been over there. It's really kind of neat if you get a chance to go over there and visit, or if you want me to set it up. They have a really nice organization. They actually have developed training modules. For example, they had an entrepreneur, how to be an entrepreneur training module that they actually rolled out into the high schools that they were using for high school teachers to train kids. And it was so successful, they actually are now using it to train entrepreneurs, how to be entrepreneurs, and you can get it online and get in. The Forensics Institute is involved in training people who work like in the state DNA labs all over the nation. They'll bring them in and they'll train them how to do the latest analyses, usually using DNA technologies. One of the questions you might ask yourself is, how does this benefit the university other than workforce development and our partnerships with the community? And we do have a master's in forensics program that has evolved from this, I think, primarily in chemistry. But in addition to that, we've been able to obtain research funding. For example, one of our investigators, Igor Lednev, is developing a Raman spectroscopy technique that can actually determine if you have blood at a crime scene. He can determine whether it's human, dog, whatever. And so we are getting research money back in that way to the campus as well as trained kids. Next slide, please. So there's some additional ones that I wanted to just put up here. And again, the $18 million for the Center for International Development is going to jump out at you. This came to us 2 years ago. They go out to different parts of the world, like Lebanon, and they're involved in helping those governments set up democracies. One of the other centers that was operating independently, but really kind of did the same thing, is the Center for Legislative Development, which was headed up by Ann Carroll. Unfortunately, that center is going to close this year, probably in November or December. The CID, Center for International Development, is headed up by Malcolm
Einhorn.
Thank you. They're really what I would call public service programs. They don't really do research, but they do involve our faculty to some extent in some of their reconnaissance work that they do outside of the United States.
Some very interesting locations. Exotic Afghanistan.
You wouldn't want to be there.
Believe places me. You would not want to go.
Yeah. Your housing allowance includes flak jackets and things like
security,
that.
A big component is security.
Next slide, please. I just wanted to give you sort of a bird's eye view of what we're really talking about when we talk about the impact of these units on the university. So in terms of just looking within the units, looking across the whole university, if we just look on our side of Fuller Road, not including the College of Natskill Science and Engineering, we've spent about $103 million this year in research, okay? And so of that piece of the pie, our centers, which are in the light blue color, are generating about 75% of that business, of that expenditures. And our academic units that are, just the Department of Biology, but not a center that may have people in biology working with it, are generating about $27 million. Next slide. Then I just wanted to finish up by just really reiterating what I said before, that if you look at the portfolio of these units, about 15% of it is really organized research. The rest of it is public service and training. Next slide, please. How have we been doing? Over the past 5 years, it's been up and down in terms of the total expenditures and just in the organized research units. And in the next slide, you'll see that our training and public service piece has really gone up. This increase here is probably due mainly to Jean Monaco's shop, and then in the past 2 years, this is probably the increase when CID came on board. Gene's work brings in probably 33% of the facilities administrative costs, that facilities administrative money that comes in as an indirect cost to the grant. Next slide, please. George already gave you the update. The two most recent additions are the Institute for RNA Science and Technology and Financial Market Regulation. And I should say that this doesn't just happen. People don't just say, okay, I'm going to create an institute. They put together a business plan, which includes the sustainability piece. They put together where their initial funding is coming from, and then they present this to a Senate committee called the Council on Research. And the Council on Research has to approve their plans in order for them to become a center. And one of the things that I need to do if I'm still in this job in the next few years is to start looking at our portfolio of centers and asking the questions, do we really need to have them? Are they really doing what they're supposed to be doing for the past 5 years?
By way of conforming, we had indicated that the Institute for Financial Market Regulation actually started in 2006. It didn't become an institute until 9/10, but it was a program
right.
In 2006.
Right. The other issue
that is very clear here is that the indirect cost recovery for all of those public service programs is extremely modest, and the actual support that we get, that we can allocate, is for example, you might get an 8% indirect cost recovery for one of those programs, and a 50% or 50 plus percent indirect cost recovery from a federal program. That's why we need to basically pursue a lot more federal dollars, because that's the way we're going to create more fiscal viability.
No, it's actually a point that I probably should have made, is that when you think about both the state and the federal interest in having the universities partner with them to accomplish their programs, they're leveraging against us to actually sustain those programs by cost sharing. And some of that cost sharing goes anywhere from 20% to 70%. And if our faculty are cost sharing, then our students are actually paying for those federal and state programs, not my office.
Yeah.
So it's a real big piece. However, Gene brings in so much of the FNA that comes to campus simply because the scale of his work is so large. Next slide, please. So I just wanted to end with one of the most recent of our institutes, and you've all met Dave McCaffrey. I was going to introduce you to him, but George beat me to it.
Sorry.
And I invited Dave to come just in case you had any questions or things that you would like to ask him about the process he went through to getting approved, where he sees it heading, and you know, what's the connection, how does the university benefit from it, or anything else you'd like to. But before we do that, does anybody have any questions for me?
So it's just the mix of undergraduate and graduate students. Is there any sort of rules of thumb or composition when you're putting this together from a student standpoint?
It's a really important question, and one of the things I keep telling center directors is, you know, you're out there teaching classes, you're out there training graduate students and postdocs, mainly. If it's advanced research, really they're going to be
right.
Training. You guys aren't doing a good enough job about telling the president and the provost what you're doing, and you need to always have that on your annual reports. Access is really through the faculty. So any faculty member who's a part of a center or is involved in that mission, who has an undergraduate who's interested in working with them, they're going to be able to access that intellectual capital that's present in those centers and institutes. David?
I can make a quick comment on that. The Financial Industry Regulatory Authority is the largest private sector regulator of the securities industry. FINRA had a training class of 10 for their member firm examination program this summer, and 5 of the students in the training program were from Albany.
That's great.
So, and actually, this is an example, because what happens is you often get students connected with research from the centers, and that feeds into your academic program. So, you know, the student connection is really important.
Yep.
I wanted to build on that real quick. With all these technologies and opportunities and skills that companies are coming here to contract with or to have research done, the opportunity for students to be just down the hall and get hands-on or person-to-person interaction is a huge advantage once they do get out of this. So
yeah.
I love hearing about all these different things, especially the Cancer Research Center.
Right. As administrators, I guess we're not supposed to, you know, come up with curriculum, but I think that one of the things we could do better in terms of the undergraduates is if you look at the RIT model, where their students, undergraduates, are doing internships in industry in the junior and senior years, our students have 399 and 499 courses that they take in their junior and senior years. I know because I've had them in my lab almost every semester at the Wadsworth Center, training them. They come with very little skills in terms of actually how to even hold a pipette. Sorry, but it's true. And so we actually, you know, lose ground on our research projects by taking these kids into our labs and training them, but we do it because I think that's what we should do. We need to frame shift that up in the freshman and sophomore years, get them into the culture, in this, not holding a pipette, but actually understanding the culture of that research group in the freshman year, having them actually start doing research in the sophomore year, and then putting them into industry in the junior and senior years. And when I've talked to people at GE about that or at AMRI, they're all ears. They're very, very interested in that. One potential way to do that is Hudson Valley Community College has just gotten a huge grant to train their students for 2 years.
President's new program.
I forget the guy's name. I just met him at a CEG meeting. But, you know, those kids are going to finish in 2 years, and a lot of them think they're going to end up in clean rooms. But they're also training them how to use confocal microscopes. They're training them how to do DNA analysis. I'm thinking, wow, you know, if we could snag those kids to come in and finish up for a BS degree in their junior and senior years, but we don't need to keep them in our labs. We can put them in industry. There will be our kids graduating from UAlbany, but they will be partnering with industry. And they're coming in fully trained from HBCC. So that's on my list of things to do, is to meet with that guy and see. Al Millis from biology is already partnering with him, but I don't think he's discussed this other idea.
A lot of those guys find their way to CNSC already, right?
Well,
it's funny, you just mentioned I was teaching an undergrad last week and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, they have used our faculty to partner with them to teach them how to do things, which is great.
That's great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
I have a question just for Dr. Caffrey. I know that'll segue in. I didn't know if you were going to do that. First of all, I think it's a great great thing that you're doing, and endeavor that you're taking time to use every day. Being in the right place at the right time, I think, is great. Do you have a brochure yet? I mean, are we starting to kind of put together some of these materials, or do you already have anything?
We have an undergraduate major and minor in financial market regulation, and actually we're now updating the brochure. It originally came out in 2008. We're doing a revision on it. What we do need is a brochure on the Institute generally, which covers not only the educational component, but also the research component. So we don't have a brochure.
But you're again working with FINRA and the other SROs, and people know they know the nature of what we're doing here.
I think, and George.
Pat can hear you.
George.
Yeah, speak a little.
Here, why don't you take this, sir, so that you'll be able to hear.
Is it possible to put up the slide with the
amendment? I'll do that while you're chatting. Escape. And then the next one down.
Yeah, actually, just really quick.
Just do the end or next.
This, I think, is the single most important part of the Institute for Financial Market Regulation. And again, and not taking anything away from us at the university, but I think that this is our distinctive. I think that this is our distinctive advantage. The faculty and students at UAlbany and at Albany Law School are working with people who are absolutely central in the industry and regulatory community in this program, and that has enormous benefit in terms of the research and also the educational side. As I mentioned, we've got half of the FINRA member examination training class, and a lot of that came from the fact that when the students graduated, they already knew a number of key folks at FINRA. And so as we develop our research and educational programs, it's just, and you know, Vice President Diaz stressed the importance of, you know, reaching out to the outside world. You know, we call it the advisory council. It's really not an advice. You know, they provide advice to us, but they are an equal part in the delivery of everything that we do. I mean, they are fully integrated into the research and the academic programs, and that's how we've got to develop. So yeah, they're we do need to put together a brochure. I mean, they're very familiar with what we do. We need to put together a brochure because we need to reach out more broadly.
Right.
So, absolutely.
Yeah. I can see, you know, certainly some of the banks and maybe not the bigger ones, but even some of the smaller ones and the different hedge funds and compliance is the soup du jour now. And, you know, being able to get our name on the forefront there at least as a resource.
Right.
Initial resource rather than going through the FINRAs and stuff and then kind of figuring out that
sure.
way.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we're doing it. Why not take credit for it?
Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's wonderful. Thanks, James. Thanks, David. Wayne, you're the man of the hour.
Thanks, Dan, very much. You should have in your packet
a report that you received in advance. Before I walk you through this report, let me say how wonderful it was to hear the undergraduate student representative talk about how students are feeling about their educational experience, and that the feeling that things are getting better and that you're valuing the education that you receive here a bit more. That's great, because that goes such a far way for us in our recruitment efforts, and our current students obviously are an extension of our admissions officers who are out there every day. What you have in front of you is a snapshot, which is pretty much final. Very little will change as any second now. We will close the chapter on fall 2009 class, at least the entering undergraduates and a new to program graduates, although there'll be some activity from the returning graduate students. Nonetheless, let me say, to start off by saying that 2010 recruiting year was a very interesting year for us. And it was interesting because 2009 was extremely interesting for us. If you look at 08 versus 09, you see some considerable progress, significant progress was made, particularly in terms of the profile of the class. And we think some of that was generated by the economic conditions of the time. You remember that a lot of uncertainty there, and we believe that students who would not ordinarily have been in the public market in higher education were in the public market in 09 because of the uncertainty with the economics. And a lot of that made, of course, a lot of the private institutions very nervous. They responded this year by putting more merit scholarship out on the table and discounting at a greater rate than they have in previous years. So I think, to put this in context, because one could make the mistake of looking at 2010 and saying, oh, well, the class is not as strong, or we didn't do as well as we did in 09. I think you have to go back to 08 and use that as a benchmark and say, okay, where are we? How much progress are we making at this point? So we went over 22,000 applications in 09 for the first time in the university's history. But more significantly, we began to move below the 50% in the admit rate at 47.1%. This year, we were able to sustain that selectivity rating. The admit rate is also at 47.1%. The registered students to date is 2243. Our target was 2250. We've been on a path of decreasing the number of new freshmen in, and I must say that it's pretty remarkable to come within 7 of your target on the base of over 2,200 students. I mean, that's kind of unheard of in our world. But nonetheless, the magic of our folks in the admissions office. You can see the mean GPA is 90.5. It was 90.7 a year ago. And in 08, 89.7. But still 20% of our students in the top 10% of their class. And the SAT score, again, above 1160 at 1161. It was 1164 a year ago. But 2 years ago, 1151. So still a 10-point difference than it was 2 years ago. Again, over on a base of 2,000 students. I mean, that's very significant. So our challenge this year was to see, wow, you know, we know what happened last year in 09. Can we sustain that? Can we mirror 09's performance in terms of maintaining that profile academically of our class? We didn't exactly mirror it, but we came pretty damn close. And our hats are off to our admissions folks and folks that work in the financial aid, student financial services area, and our advising services area. You see the special programs, the number of scholars, 191 in this year's class, 117 in the Honors College, comparable ratio of male-female, still about 50-50 on both sides. Point out the students of color has jumped to 36. Percent of the class. But I also want to point out, I think what's feeding that, if you look at 2008, there were 17% that were unknown. The list of choices now are much greater, so students can identify more closely with where they would like to be, and they have more choices, so they can find a box that more closely represents them. And I think that's what's going on here, as the federal government and state government has mandated how that we change the selection that we provide for students. You can see on the geographic distribution going the wrong direction on the out-of-state, 7.4 in 08, and just 5.3 in 2010. That's a function of many things, including resources, including increase in out-of-state tuition, and including a number of things. So we have to regroup on our out-of-state initiatives. On the back is a breakout of transfer admissions. And you can see in 2010 we have an enrolled class of 1393. We were trying to, our target was actually from a financial standpoint 1350. We're trying to get 1400 if we can do it without diminishing the quality of the transfer population. So we're at 1393 while maintaining a 2.5 grade point average for the class coming in. And actually, the mean grade point average for transfer students coming in this year is 3.2 compared to 3.1 a year ago. So we're very, very pleased that we were able to get close to the 1400 while improving the entering GPA on those students. We were hitting the mark on the new to program graduate students at 1168. And that's compared to 1113. I want to share one other thing with you because I think it's important. Find my note here. And that has to do with the College of Nanoscale Science and Engineering. This year was the first year that we enrolled true first-time freshmen to the College of Nanoscale Science. And 13 of those students that we've admitted enrolled. And the mean grade point average, or the mean SAT score for those students is 1373 with a mean high school GPA of 94. Okay? 1373 and a 94 GPA. Just imagine if we had 200 engineers in our freshman class, what the profile would look like.
Yes.
Okay? That's what they bring to the table. Good. Overall, as I said, we're going to close the books in a couple of days. I know there's a couple of stragglers on the graduate side, returning students out there to yet to register. But we're at right now 99.1% of our overall target. That'll inch up just a bit. I think we're in pretty good shape this year overall. I'll take any questions.
What's the tuition for out-of-state students now?
Last year it was $10,007, and for 2010, I want to say 13. Well, but how much was it? I'm having a sophomore moment. The tuition for out-of-state tuition went from $10,007 to.
It's up to 14 now.
14 for this year.
This coming up.
That's a huge jump, right? Obviously, that reflects itself.
Yeah.
So I mean, SUNY's not a good buy if you're looking for less expensive SUNY state systems. I mean,
They were informed late, as by the way. You know, I mean, we tell them, hey, this is what we believe your tuition is going to be, 10-7, and then all of a sudden in August, we hit them with a bill that's 14. So.
A study that was done by the State Comptroller's Office, which was incredibly interesting, that they compared tuitions at the University of Vermont, which is essentially a private school. They compared out-of-state tuitions to the University of Virginia, University of North Carolina. For all intents and purposes, you're talking about apples and oranges. And they really, the Rockefeller Institute did a study that, in effect, at least addressed the concept of diminishing returns. So. You know, we went from 8% to what, 5? Is that the numbers that we went at in terms of out-of-state enrollment? So at the end of the day, if you add up the 5% number of students times the tuition, we lost money. We had to fill those seats with 4,970 seats instead of 12-something thousand seats. So,
right.
But most of the people that did that did not graduate from Albany.
George, you might have missed this earlier point that I made regarding the kids that came into Nano. This is the first time that we had true freshmen into the College of Nano, and there are 13 of them, and their mean SAT score is 1373 and a 94 GPA. And I said, just imagine if we had 200 engineers in our freshman class, what that would do to the profile.
The numbers are clearly going to improve, and frankly, the quality of the transfer students that you took in early were incredible.
Yep.
That's a good thing. But my hope is that it's not just going to be an anomaly for Nano. It's going to be something that we're going to be able to strive for throughout the university.
Yeah.
Wayne, I'm sorry, Dr.
Did you get any presidential scholars in August? Any late applicants?
We get one or two, not too many that late. One or two, and we'll take them anytime we can get them.
I know you said that, but that's, I recall in the last meeting you mentioned that, and I just was curious that you didn't happen to enroll it that late. Yeah.
One or two, maybe.
Right. Okay.
That late. Yeah.
And you go ahead.
Please go ahead.
The decrease in the number of presidential scholars in Honors College, was that by design, or is that just the way the numbers break? Or
no, I think that's actually a reflection again of what happened the year before.
Right. They went way up, obviously. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. That's what happened between 08 and 09 when you have those students and families out there thinking about the economy.
Right.
And those students that that we yielded at a higher level were at the top end of our academic profile.
For the meritorious students, there's more competition again because privates are going
and the privates put more money on the table this year because of what happened last year.
Right.
Yeah.
And they put a lot of money on the table. As a matter of fact, some of the privates are cheaper than us. In particular, that hurt us in terms of out-of-state enrollment as well.
Yep.
Did you talk about retention?
I didn't get into it. We're seeing some good signs. We have been seeing good signs all along on the retention front. For the last 3 or 4 years, we've been seeing like a half a point of improvement with returning students.
What are those numbers? I was just going to say, that was one of my questions. I take it off. It would be great to see that if you could see it on the next.
I'll do that on the next report. I'll lay out the retention because because we're going to close the book soon on this year. Mm-hmm. But we're already seeing now, for example, we have 75 more returning students than our model projected. So that means that there's improvement on the retention end. We're just not sure at what level. Was it sophomore to junior? Was it junior to senior? But we'll know that when we crunch the numbers, and I'll prepare another
great
report.
Great updated model, which we did after last year when we had
absolutely
greater retention.
Yeah.
So this is sort of cumulative
as
it moves along.
Right.
Okay. Sorry.
The only other question I wanted to ask you was the I don't think maybe you've seen, given it, and I just didn't look at it, I'd love to see just what's going on with the EOP program. And I understand that's separate and just, you know, actually it's a question. When you report numbers for national, do we include those, you know, EOP and what other types of special admission categories that could, I'm assuming, would potentially lower our numbers with respect to the mean SAT and stuff? Are they specifically excluded? Or
The specials such as EOP are excluded out of the profile. So the profile that I give you, the academic profile, SAT scores, mean GPA, are on our traditional admits.
And incidentally, that's what's done at every campus.
Yeah.
This
is
not unique to us. That's every single campus.
And SUNY says that we can have 18 or 19% fall into special categories. For example, international students, because they don't have SAT scores for the most part. They're not included in the academic profile. EOP students are not included in the profile. Profile as well.
Would it be possible just to get a breakout of that? Because we're all students, as we all know, and I would love to. I've always seen that footnote, and I kept meaning to ask you just to.
And you will see a similar trend with EOP students because I reported to that with senior staff a while back that the EOP students, for example, their academic profile has been going steadily up as well.
And I'd love to see the trip for that also.
Okay.
That way you can get like a full 360 and you can kind of.
I think you'll be pleased with the retention rate for our EOP students.
Yeah.
You know, it's not what you would think. It's very good.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And also, just keep in mind, you see these numbers, 158, 138, 133. Those numbers are given to us by the state. Okay. Those are funded numbers. So they tell us how many students we can fund. They provide the funding for it. So we don't control the number of students that go into the EOP program.
Huh. Interesting. Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, why is it? Why is it formula? I mean, I'm just trying to. Is it special funding that you get?
It is special funding, yes. The special funding that we get for the EOP program.
Which every year gets cut, yeah. And every year gets restored
yes.
to the previous level, which means that after 10 years of that scenario, it is way underfunded because at the end of the day, you're still getting money that was equivalent of 10 years earlier.
I see.
For the numbers. So there's never any increase. The best you can hope for is a restoration, and it's a game they go through.
Every year.
When we saw the cuts, we said, okay, so we know the EOP money will be restored to previous level. It's almost a game. It's a game.
Yeah.
And frankly, it's a way that people actually shirk their responsibility because, you know, they take great credit for restoring the funding to an inadequate level.
Is that a real dollar basis for 2000?
Here's a question about the...
How much outreach is done out of state and internationally? Do you have dedicated resources to go out of state?
Well,
yeah, the internet.
Thank you for that.
The internet.
We're now
going to
get a commercial.
Do you really want to know? let me say that we're regrouping and revisiting our out-of-state and international recruitment strategies. We had to make modifications over the last couple of years, honestly, but we're going to go back to the drawing board and see what we need to do to provide more energy into those efforts. And actually, a good chunk of it is going to involve, to the extent possible, our out-of-state and international alumni to get on board in a more aggressive manner. So you'll be hearing more about that. How was that?
That's very good. He told you what he really wanted to say is that he's been cut to the core. He's sick and tired of being expected to deliver with fewer and fewer resources on an annual basis. But he was very polite.
Yes. Yeah.
The question is, the students from Hudson Valley, you have many of them transferring in after 2 years into the nanotech program?
Into the nanotech program.
Yeah.
That I don't know.
Yeah. Nanotech has it's a 2+1 program with Hudson Valley directly where they'll spend like a year and a half in Hudson Valley and then they'll spend a 6-month plus 6-month interval at CNSE. They'll get the Hudson Valley degree, but they'll get the CNSE experience.
It's a workforce training model, not necessarily... remember we had the chat about the fact that the two-year colleges are getting more and more, you know, they're getting much more attention because of the need for very specific workforce training. Nano actually enhances the workforce training because Hudson Valley doesn't have the level of sophistication, and nor should they be expected to have, to fully train people in that arena. But these are two-year graduates, which are in great demand, especially with Global Foundries,
right.
Because the lion's share of their technicians are going to be two-year graduates mm-hmm. with very specific workforce training elements that can be provided by NAC, not their undergraduate cadre. Okay. It's not their baccalaureate group.
That said, we do have a significant portion of our transfer students
yes.
come from Hudson
yes.
Valley.
Yes, for other
but
programs.
But not necessarily into
the nano. Okay.
Now, what about, take for example an area like mathematics, for example. Have you found those students coming in to the regular university, how are they performing? Are they graduating at the same rate as kids who started from the
Maybe.
Beginning of the university?
Yep. We typically find that transfer students, when they come in, after a semester or two of adjustment, because the level of expectations, particularly those
sure.
coming from the community college, is a little different,
sure.
That they tend to graduate from here on par with our native students. Okay. So there's a catch-up period, but once that they typically do catch up.
Okay. Thank you very much, Wayne.
Yep.
We're informative. Look forward to hearing back from you when the books are closed. One new person, or the once and future king, I don't know, Sorrel Chesson, where is Sorrel? Sorrel is here. I didn't recognize Sorrel, who is serving as secretary.
It's me.
Unless you want to run away. Yeah.
No, it's you. Thank you.
It's great to have you back. A wonderful resource and a true gentleman and a great asset to the university, and really appreciate you, you know, lending your services here to us on the council, and it's wonderful to have you.
Were you gone?
he's gone from this body.
Were you gone from this body?
Just for a short period.
Yeah. So good to have you back. And in your packet, I did would like to introduce a resolution recognizing and thanking Jim Dolefeld, who, you know, was involved with the university for a long time, obviously, but specifically in his role in serving, you know, recently as secretary for the council. Jim was a great resource and an asset, and like a lot of things, things come together with a lot of hard work and elbow grease from the people that you don't see. And Jim was one of those guys constantly working, you know, get us prepared, work with the limited resources we had to help advance things. And I can tell you, in particular on the search, you know, his energy and efforts to help were wonderful. And that was a 7-day-a-week exercise. So Jim's not here, but we do have a resolution here today recognizing Jim's work. So somebody would offer.
Move approval.
Okay.
Second.
Great. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Great. Thank you very much. I think there are some highlights here on some upcoming events. I don't know if you wanted to.
Yeah, I've got a.
Oh, I'm sorry, Pierre.
Yeah, I just I just wanted to put a commercial plug in for the Association of College Trustees. It's going to be held locally at the Desmond due to budget constraints. We have reduced it from a 2-day or 3-day to a one overnight, a 2-day event on Friday evening. It appears that we may very well have Liz Benjamin, who does NYY9 or Capital News Tonight or whatever they're calling it now, have a debate between Bruce Jury and Dave Cotelfamo, kind of a pre-election, prior-to-election discussion, which should prove entertaining. The Friday morning or the Saturday morning sessions are on the Chancellor's strategic plan and the implementation with the business community, et cetera. And then the Chancellor will be there for the noon presentation of the scholarship awards that the Association of College Trustees give out. And I'm pleased that the University at Albany has a contender in the and for consideration of the scholarship. The local campus is considered the host of ACT, and so I'm also pleased that the University at Albany will be designated the host. Well, I know you probably are busy, but George will be doing the welcoming, et cetera, on Friday night. So I know that you got to save the date and the other stuff in the mail. If you have any questions, feel free to contact us. The university will pick up the lodging, but all the meals and everything else are paid for by the association. So it's a minimal expense all the way around. The other thing, if I could, one particular thing, I'm also involved in the NCAA accreditation, of which George said there's accreditation program on every particular program going all the way through. But one of the things that was important through the NCAA is the governance committee and what effect and what role that the council plays, the Board of Trustees and the council plays. I would ask that the council consider perhaps at our next meeting a resolution and an invitation for the Vice President, Dr. McElroy, to come and present it to us on his plans. He does it to the Senate, and he does it generally in February, so perhaps we would entertain inviting him here the first quarter of 2011, and that will help as we build the certification plan and going forward. So, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Pierre. Any other business people want to raise?
The information for next meeting.
Okay. Searle, maybe you
want to
comment on more.
Yes. The legal counsel for us is working with the parking management, and they're going to be proposing some modifications to our campus traffic regulation. Dan had asked that when action like this will be taken, that the information be provided to the council at a meeting, but not the meeting where the council is expected to take action. So this material is in your packet for review between now and the next meeting on November 5th. And I will try to work with others on campus where they're expecting you to take action. Well, this is something very routine, like the resolution on Jim Nolefeld, an acknowledgement that you have ample time, which is what Dan asked you to do, to consider these rather than the day before the meeting comes up. So I will be doing that. And that's what this packet is in your packet for now.
Great. Thank you, sir.
Just one other point quickly. the Citizen Laureate Dinner, which is a major fundraising event for the university this year, where we have actually 550 people at the Hall of Springs, at least 500, which is going to be by far the most impressive number we've ever had. It's something that you might want to think about. We're honoring John Nigro, who is a local businessman, and Sally Temple, who is a researcher here at the, who's located at the Cancer Center, who's very much involved with stem cell research. I'm starting to be an old man here. Homecoming, which is next, not this weekend, but next weekend? Yeah, next weekend. Lots of activities, lots of events.
First
home game.
Who's it against?
St. Francis,
yeah.
I read that somewhere.
Yeah, Duquesne is tomorrow, I guess. I'm trying to remember the... in any event, all of the events that are listed here are interesting and fun, and if you get an opportunity, please join us on campus.
I encourage everybody to go any and all. Can I get a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second. All in favor? Thank you, Pat.
Thank you, Pat.
You have the tape or what's on it?
I probably would have done that.
Here you go. I got it. Thank you.
Did we miss anybody?